Hello, welcome to The Debate. I'm Kavit Tavli. Sudan's information minister has said that the U.S. President Donald Trump wanted to use Sudan as an election card by pressuring it to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. This spells just one side of the story behind Sudan's normalization deal with Israel. What about other Arab countries? Were they also pressured by the U.S. into normalizing ties with Israel? What did they have to give up, and what did they get in return? And what about the rights of Palestinians? Whatever happened to that? Just some of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Debate. First, let's bring in Ahmed Caballo. He was the person who actually interviewed the information minister to bring us that exclusive coverage and the revelation of the facts. So, Ahmed, tell us about the interview and, of course, what you discovered.
Yeah, to be honest, he gave a very frank interview, much more frank than I was anticipating. And he essentially admitted that Sudan was blackmailed into this decision. He said, from when the transitional government took power, they began negotiating with the US to delist Sudan as a state sponsor of terror. And from day one, they made it clear to the US that it had nothing to do with Israel and nothing to do with normalizing ties with Israel. And the US allegedly agreed to those conditions. And it was just merely a couple of weeks before the election that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo changed his mind and said that no, it had to be the principal condition. And if they wanted the state sponsor of terror designation lifted, they had to normalize relations with Israel, which left the transitional government in a very tricky position because the economy was flatlining. The economic minister said that the economy wouldn't last 7 months. So they had to assess their options, and they thought, shall we gamble on a Joe Biden administration? And then they thought, if they gamble on a Joe Biden administration, the problem is that it'll take another 7 months coming with a fact-finding mission, and they might reach the same conclusion. So they were forced to accept a decision that they'd not want to due to the economic pressure in Sudan, due to the long queues for fuel, for bread, and the economic crisis that's currently riddling the country.
So basically from what you're saying is the fact that you had Mike Pompeo that came and gave a different type of approach to the whole scenario, of which I'm assuming that is where you have used the word blackmail, which is indeed what actually transpired based on the way that Pompeo made his request from Sudan. Is that a correct way of looking at it?
Yes, and I asked the minister if he felt that the United States were using the economic situation in Sudan to leverage Sudan to normalize relations with Israel. Now, he gave a diplomatic answer, but if you read between the lines, he essentially admitted that, yes, they knew we were struggling, they knew we had no other options, and they knew that we were going to accept this deal because there was nowhere else for our economy to go.
Okay, very well. Let me now bring in our guests to discuss this a little bit further. Journalist and activist Khaled Barakat joins us from Vancouver. Khaled Barakat, welcome. Our reporter there, Ahmed Caballo, who traveled to Sudan and gave us that interview, of which we came up with this revelation now, which is the topic of our debate, amongst other issues that we're going to discuss. First, let me get a reaction from you of how you think that the U.S. actually used or pressured Sudan into this, of which, as our reporter said, Michael Pompeo, to actually to move forward in a blackmail-type scenario in order to get the normalization deal out of Sudan with Israel.
That is an excellent question, and I think that the U.S. always put pressure on states in order to normalize relationship with Israel. It's not just Sudan. In this case, we know more information because of this interview and also other reports that have indicated clearly that Sudan was pressured into this relationship with Israel. But even some of the Arab reactionary regimes, but they are pressured in a different way. Still, that, you know, they're trying to spread the fear in the Arab world that Israel will protect you from Iran, which is a false statement, and also trying to prove or, you know, tell all states in the area that the only way to you to get to the White House and a normal relationship with the U.S., you have to go through Tel Aviv. Basically, if you want to normalize your relationship with the U.S., you have to go through Israel as their allies in the region. Pressure always have been used, sometimes economic pressure, sometimes political pressure. And one of these ways, is especially with illegitimate regimes and governments, that, this card, the U.S. could use it anytime. We know that today, for example, Israel have military bases in Africa, in some of the islands along the Red Sea, and this also exerts military pressure. Some of its nuclear submarines are roaming in the Mediterranean and in the Red Sea. So all of these factors are, just normal understanding and general wisdom of the people of the area. If it's up to people and even states, if it's up to them, they will not normalize with Israel.
Anna Caballo, when we take a look at the situation in Sudan, prior to that, of course, you had its former president that was there. But, there was a point way back when Sudan had pretty much adamantly stated that it will not have any relationship with Israel, that it would not normalize ties with Israel. And this obviously requires a history check. At what point did the U.S., and I'm guessing along with Israel, feel like there was now an opportunity in order to move forward and make this request or demand, or should I say blackmail, Sudan into this? Could you give us a little bit of a rundown there if you can?
That's a great question. In my analysis, it was when the Saudi UAE faction of the military dictatorship took over. So within the military apparatus, there is a split between the Muslim Brotherhood aligned factions and the Saudi UAE aligned factions. And what happened when Omar al-Bashir was overthrown in April was that Hemeti and Burhan, who were aligned to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, they took control of the military and became the most powerful men in the country. And when that happened, it became clear that normalizing with Israel was again on the cards, because Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, of course, more keen with relations with Israel than, say, the Brotherhood bloc. And that is when they saw this opportunity. So it was also the fact that Sudan has been considered a pariah state for a long time. And the only way to get access to Washington, as my colleague just mentioned, was to prove to Washington that it now was a reliable client state. And by normalizing relations with Israel, it proves to Washington that Sudan can once again be trusted as a source of influence in the region. Because before that, if we remember in the 90s, Omar al-Bashir had very close relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And now it's quite clear that it's distanced itself from the Islamic Republic of Iran and is very much in the Saudi-Emirati axis.
Okay. Well, Khalid Barakat, we know that this deal has come weeks after the similar moves that were made by the United Arab Emirates and also Persian Gulf island of Bahrain. The two have become now the first to recognize Israel in 26 years. Tell us whether you think what type of pressure was exerted on them to come out and make the announcement and to formalize this, even though, of course, it's been said that they have had a relationship with Israel behind the scenes.
Well, in principle, there is a camp that is led by the United States and Israel and the Arab reactionary regimes, especially regimes like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and others. And we need to remember that this camp have an alliance that goes back way back, even to 2012, in a real way. But there is always a secret doors and relationships between these regimes and Israel. Every couple of months, we see a new report that date back these relationships to even after 1967 war. We have to remember that after the 1967 occupation and aggression that Israel launched, Sudan, for example, was the capital that declared no reconciliation, no recognition, and no relationship with Israel. And so for them, Sudan is kind of more of a sentimental, more of a relationship than United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. And later on, down the line, the Saudis are going to come along also and normalize the relationship. But Saudi Arabia, you know, that's the big chunk in the peace that Israel is looking at. And the most important thing to remember is that this kind of policies, it is used on the basis of the carrot and the stick. So either, you know, these regimes are getting the carrots or they are get the stick. And basically because they don't have any sense of legitimacy in the country. So, for example, they cannot do that with Tunisia, for example, because we have an elected president in Tunisia. We have a public opinion, very strong political movement, anti-normalization in Tunisia. So they will not be able to pressure Tunisia because it is, it has a democratic institution. But these Arab regimes, they lack these legitimacy. They depend very much on the protection of the United States and now Israel.
Very well. Let me bring in Michael Lane now. He's a political analyst who joins us from Washington, D.C., to bring him into the conversation. Michael Lane, welcome. So let me first get a reaction from you. You know, we have got information firsthand that Sudan's information minister has said that the U.S. President Donald Trump wanted to use Sudan as an election card by pressuring it to normalize ties with Israel. Your reaction to that?
Well, it's not surprising. I mean, when you look at the timing of these successes, it was something that the Trump administration had been working toward for a number of years. It was part of their strategy to follow down this route. But when you had three countries, all of whom decided that they were going to play this card and normalize relationships with Israel in the just several months and in some cases only weeks leading up to the election, it was something that the Trump administration worked very, very hard on the timing and getting them to fall before the election rather than after the election. I wouldn't be surprised to hear widespread reports at some time that the Trump administration was pressuring any number of countries to take this step before the election.
When you talk about the U.S. placing pressure, i.e. Donald Trump placing that pressure perhaps, then, you know, there could be an observation on that, that there's an or else, meaning a precondition. For example, do you think that there was a precondition set here, as our reporter indicated, through the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who said that if you want to be taken off the terror list, you have to make this formal, the normalization with Israel. Do you think that that was the case?
You know, there are a number of techniques and tools that the United States would use, the Trump administration or any administration for that matter, the State Department, that they would use in dealing with our both our allies, our friends, and our adversaries in terms of influencing them to do things that we would like to see influenced. So, you know, would it be an exact quid pro quo, if you do A, then we will do or allow B? It would surprise me if that was used in many circumstances. I can't confirm that it was used in these circumstances. We simply don't know. On the other hand, it might be more general talk about, okay, well, you know, we provide so much in foreign aid to y'all, and, you know, if you would like to see that foreign aid continue at that level or even increase, then we would like to see some cooperation on some things that are important to us. On the other hand, if you can't see your way clear to cooperating on this one particular issue that's important to us, we can't guarantee that Congress will continue to do the foreign aid funding at the same level that it has. Some of the threats can be more direct and more overt than others. Sometimes they can be extraordinarily subtle, but the message still gets across that we are friends, we share a similar point of view. This is one of the things on which we really want you to share our point of view, and there will be rewards, there are carrots and or sticks as we go through, depending on how much of our point of view you share.
Okay, let's talk about the stick, but that's important. Khaled Barakat, I mean, when we take a look at the way that the U.S. may have pressured countries like Sudan, like the Persian Gulf island of Bahrain, or with the UAE, how far do you think the U.S. actually pressured them into coming out, making sure that this is something that needs to be out in the open, this so-called normalization with Israel. I mean, do you think that the U.S. exerted a lot of pressure on them in order for this to, again, be out in the open? And also at the same time, I know it's two questions in one. We have to talk about the Palestinian concern here, the topic of Palestine. It doesn't seem to be the number one priority when it comes to the so-called normalization of ties when it comes to these countries.
Well, you have to remember that the mere existence of these regimes depends on the protection of the United States and now the United States and Israel. We also need to remember that these regimes are not really reflecting the will and the sentiment and the position of the people in the country. We know, for example, the regime of Bahrain. This is a regime that absolutely lack all forms of legitimacy in Bahrain. The people of Bahrain, the vast majority of the people of Bahrain, has been engaged in peaceful demonstrations and uprising, and they have been brutalized by this regime. And so the ruling class of Bahrain wants to protect its interest and its wealth by associating itself with the United States and Israel now, because it's closer. Also, it lures them the fact that the Palestinians are not in their best shape, and that Palestinians are weak, and they look at the Palestinian angle and they see that there will be no reaction, real reaction by Palestinian leadership and Palestinian factions, and therefore nothing will deter these regimes from going into more and more public relationship with Israel. And this is not really normalizing relationship with Israel. This is really building an alliance between, you know, the Zionist colonization state of Israel and these reactionary Arab regimes. One of the things that we need to remember, that the Palestinian factor here is a determining factor. If Palestinians get their internal affairs in place and they take a real and loud position, that will, in my view, deter these Arab reactionary regimes. Nothing else will do. They're not democratic governments. They're not governments that represent the will of the people, and therefore why would they listen to Palestinians if they're not listening to the people of Bahrain? 95% of the people of Bahrain said no to normalization. This is the vast majority of the people of Bahrain, and that goes the same in Saudi Arabia and Emirates. If you will conduct a real poll amongst the people right. of the region, you know, they are against this relationship with Israel.
Okay, so Michael Lane, the Palestinian issue, can you please tell us how the U.S. is approaching that in terms of the rank and the importance that it has when it comes out to these countries that are saying that it has to come out and normalize ties with Israel? I mean, is it trying to tell Palestinians, we're just going to have countries come on board, whether you like it or not? They're announcing their normalization with Israel, and therefore you have to, for example, succumb to the terms of this so-called deal of the century, which at this point is now kind of it's at a critical juncture, because you have possibly an outgoing President Trump, along with his son-in-law Jared Kushner. But do you think that that's the approach that the U.S. is using in order to convince the Palestinians that you don't have a choice now because these countries are coming on board?
I think so, yes, if I understand the question. Look, Trump, when he announced the deal of the century and then sort of moved forward with it, had the U.S. embassy move to Jerusalem, et cetera, was still trying to get Palestinian President Abbas on the phone. And Abbas hadn't talked to him for months, perhaps as much as 2 years. I forget the exact timing on this. And when that whole thing was started, and Abbas was still refusing to discuss anything with President Trump or with his representatives, the president finally said, okay, well, we're moving ahead with this. This is what we're doing. And I'm going to leave a window open here. The window is 4 years for the Palestinians to decide that they want to come back, talk with us about what they think this agreement should look like. And there was still the door open for some modifications in it, although once it was announced and once it has passed a year, those modifications become extremely difficult to make.
I'm sorry, I got to interrupt you. I've got to jump in here, Michael, and I do apologize. I'm going to bring in Khaled Barakat with the final question in less than a minute, if you can, Khaled Barakat. Our guest there neglects to say that Israel in the past 4 years has continued with its violations of the Palestinian territories, even though the normalization of ties with the UAE, it said that it was going to freeze at least the settlement expansion, but it didn't. Do you think that right now with an outgoing U.S. president that this so-called deal of the century is going to fall flat and not go anywhere? Less than a minute.
Well, I mean, Biden is committed to keep the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. There is not going to be a lot of changes between Biden and Trump in essence, in real essence. There will be a different language used, absolutely. I know that the Palestinian Authority for sure are, clapping for Biden, and they're happy about Biden that Trump is gone now. But I don't think that any real substantial changes that Biden will bring to Palestinians.
Okay.
The only way for Palestinians to move forward is to have an alternative Palestinian revolutionary path.
Very well. We're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank our reporter at the top of the hour at the debate, Ahmed Kabayo, who spoke to us, who brought us that exclusive interview. Thank you so much, Ahmed. Also, political analyst Michael Lane spoke to us from Washington, D.C., and journalist and activist Khaled Barakat, who spoke to us from Vancouver. And that is for this edition of The Debate. For me, Khaled Tahway, the entire team is goodbye. Until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَالْبُدْنَ جَعَلْنَاهَا لَكُمْ شعائر الله لكم فيها فاذكروا اسم الله عليها صواف فإذا وجبت جنوبها فكلوا منها وأطعموا القانع والمعتر كذلك سخرناها لكم لعلكم تشكرون.
And the camels and cattle we have appointed for you as among the symbols of Allah. For you therein is good. So mention the name of Allah upon them when lined up for sacrifice. And when they are lifeless on their sides, then eat from them and feed the needy and the beggar. Thus have we subjected them to you, that you may be grateful.
So, dear listeners, we were discussing the 36th verse of this chapter, وَالْبُدْنَ جَعَلْنَهَا لَكُمْ مِنْ شَعَائِرِ اللَّهِ. And for the fat camels, we have made them for you of the symbols of Allah. لَكُمْ فِيهَا خَيْرٌ فَاذْكُرُوا اسْمَ اللَّهِ عَلَيْهَا صَوَافٌ. Therein is good for you, so mention Allah's name on them standing in a row. فَإِذَا وَجَبَتْ جُنُوبُهَا فَكُلُوا مِنْهَا. So when they fall down sacrificed on their sides, eat of them. وَأَطْعِمُوا الْقَانِعَ وَالْمُعْتَرُ. And feed the contented poor one and such as beg with due humility. كَذَلِكَ سَخَّرْنَهَا لَكُمْ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَشْكُرُونَ. Thus we have made them subservient to you, that haply you may give thanks. So we are talking about mentioning the name of Allah. No doubt, mentioning the name of Allah at the time of slaughtering the animals, while we are immolating them, does not need that a particular quality be observed, and mentioning any name of Allah is enough. The appearance of the holy verse also shows the same thing, but some narrations contain a special invocation of Allah to be mentioned, and some commentators have quoted this invocation from Ibn Abbas and says, Allahu Akbar, la ilaha illallah, wallahu akbar, Allahumma minka wa laka. So, in a narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, some more expressive sentences have been quoted. He alayhi salam has said, when you bought the sacrificial animal, do turn it toward Qibla, and at the time of slaughtering, you should say, I have turned my face wholly toward him who created the heavens and the earth being upright, and I am not of the idolaters. Verily, my prayer and my worship, my life and my death are for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Anyway, we just wanted you to know that some jurisprudents believe that merely mentioning any name of the Almighty Allah is not enough, and we have other beliefs as well. Anyway, the Quranic term sawaf is the plural form of safa, which means standing in a row, and as some Islamic narrations denote, the objective of it is that the hands of the sacrificial camel must be tied together from the wrist to the knee, so that the camel is not able to move so much and does not run away at the time of slaughtering. It is natural that when the body of the camel bleeds for a while, its hands grow weak and weaker, and finally the camel lies on the ground.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly
the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
At the end of the verse, the Holy Quran says, فَإِذَا وَجَبَتْ جُنُوبُهَا فَكُلُوا مِنْهَا. When they fall down sacrificed on their sides, eat of them. وَأَطْعِمُ الْقَانِعَ وَالْمُعْتَرَ. And feed the contented poor one and such as beg with due humility. So we have to mention the difference between qani' wal mu'tar, between the words qani' and mu'tar. The word qani' is applied to a person that when something is given to him, he is satisfied and becomes contented and happy. He shows no protest, no objection, no anger. But the word mu'tar is for a person who comes to you and asks for something, and he is often not content with what you have given him. Anyway, the point is noteworthy that the Quranic phrase kulu minha, eat of them, apparently means that the pilgrims must eat something out of their own sacrifice as an obligation, and perhaps this is for the equality between them and the poor. And it is really interesting that until this animal, the camel, is alive, we are not allowed to eat of its body and use its meat. And the meat must be divided between the poor ones and, of course, qani' wal mu'tar. And we do not care even it is a person who is coming and asking in the first place, or the one who does not ask and we know that he is poor. When we are glorifying the Almighty Allah's symbols, we care about each and every poor, and we don't care whether he is content or not. And at the ending part of the verse it says, كَذَلِكَ سَخَّرْنَاهَا لَكُمْ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَشْكُرُونَ. And thus we have made them subservient to you, that haply you may give thanks. So that big animal, such as camel, with that power and strength, is so subservient to us that it lets even a child ties his feet very firmly, and then it will be slaughtered. And sometimes, in order to show us the importance of this conquest, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala takes the command of obedience and submission from this animal, and we have seen that an angry camel, which a little boy can take its rein and lead it anywhere, sometimes turns to a dangerous being that several strong men cannot usually manage to control. So of course, this is a sign that we should be obedient to the Almighty Allah. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things goodbye. Always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala khayri khalqihi wa alihi at-tahirin.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Praise be to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and may His peace and blessings be upon the best of His creation, Prophet Muhammad, and his pure progeny. The master of the pious, Imam Ali alayhi salam, has divided people into three categories. People are either scholars or students. Also, the third group is comprised of those who are ever ready to respond to every call. They are like mosquitoes being swept away with the wind. They fly in the direction of the wind without anything like self-will. Such type of people, instead of trying to making their capabilities blossom, put a lid on their intelligence and waste it away. These people always look around for the wings of others to fly with. They are ignorant of the fact that in this world of creation, no two individuals are born with exactly equal capabilities in every field. No one can be equal to any other person in every respect, be it a matter of appearance, feeling, or likes and dislikes. The lines on the palms of one man are always different from those of all others. When the situation is such, it is very unwise on our part to bind our thinking with the thoughts of others and not to take benefits of the individual God-given abilities faculties, and proficiencies. Great people always tread their own new path. They have walked on ways which others did not tread before. They have gifted new presents to humanity. Such great people have throughout their lives been innovators, giving birth to new ideas, sciences, and industries. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.
Around the world with reporters.
Once again, the violent clashes. The police tear gassed protesters to disperse them in Pakistan's garrison city of Rawalpindi near capital Islamabad. Nonetheless, a massive crowd emerged on the streets despite chilly weather conditions. At the heart of an intense public anger is the display of a blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet of the Islam by the French government on state-run buildings last month. Since then, there has been no let-up to the protest like this in Pakistan. The frequent publications in newspapers and public display of anti-Islamic blasphemous cartoons have ignited an unprecedented scale of public resentment against France and its citizens in Pakistan. Protesters vowed to avenge the blasphemers of the Prophet of the Islam.
The honor of our Prophet is being insulted by the President of France. We demand the government official to kick out the ambassador of France right now from the Pakistan. Otherwise, these all people will protest. We will march in millions towards the embassy of France. We will march in millions, inshallah.
Being here in this weather, in this condition, against the government of France, against the officials, who they are not kicking the France ambassador from the Pakistan, why we are here? To protect our respect of our holy Prophet Muhammad Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. No one can stop us to protect the our own religion, over the respect of our holy Prophet Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
Pakistan's mainstream media largely opted to black out the coverage of this protest, allegedly under pressure to contain the agitation on this most sensitive issue. The organizers complain that their large number of protesters were arrested to prevent them to participate in the gathering. The government suspended all cell phone services and blocked all major highways to prevent the entry of angry protesters in the capital city. The extraordinary security measures have been undertaken to avert the repetition of violent clashes happened not far from French embassy in Islamabad in early this month. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
It seems the growing number of coronavirus infections and deaths has not yet sounded the alarm in Turkey's government offices to impose another lockdown in the country. The reluctance comes amid reports that the flow of tourists is still going strong in Turkey amid the pandemic, especially in its largest city of Istanbul, which has not only the highest number of tourists, but also the highest number of coronavirus infections and deaths. The city counts for about 40% of confirmed infected cases in Turkey. This number forced the mayor of Istanbul, Ekrem İmamoğlu, to call on the government to impose a total lockdown in the city for at least 2 to 3 weeks. However, his call was rejected.
When we look at the current data, it is obvious that a lockdown is absolutely necessary. I have shared this issue with all the authorities and people of Istanbul. I think a 2 to 3 week lockdown is necessary. This is highly advised by our scientists and experts.
Many believe that the government's decision is deeply rooted in its economic concerns. The government officials maintain that the closure of restaurants and public places at 10 p.m., along with social distancing and wearing masks, is enough to contain the virus.
The second wave of the coronavirus is spreading all over the world, and the situation is getting worse. Many governments may consider lockdown as an effective way to cope with the pandemic, but lockdown has its own consequences. Many people will lose their jobs, and it seems the Turkish government is now mainly concerned with the economic aspects of the lockdown.
Turkey's Cultural and Tourism Ministry announced last week that since the end of the last lockdown several months ago, the country has had 9.46 million visitors from various countries, including European ones, where the pandemic has hit the most. Those arriving to Turkey are not even being tested, which makes the spread of the virus even easier. Many here say Turkish government is favoring economy over public health. Now, the main question is how far the government may remain reluctant to meet the growing demands for lockdown as the country's coronavirus infections and death are getting out of control. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela has strongly rejected a round of one-year-long sanctions fired by the European Union, which challenges the legitimacy of the upcoming legislative elections in the Latin American nation. Nicolas Maduro made the remarks after the EU's European Council condemned a decision by the Supreme Court of Venezuela to reshuffle the composition of the country's National Electoral Council. Maduro said the move by the European body is influenced by the regime change policy of the United States, which refuses to recognize Maduro's presidency and the country's legal institutions. The Venezuelan head of state said the elections will take place despite the economic sanctions because they follow the rule of the national constitution. Officials totally back Maduro's statement.
The EU sanctions are a violation of international law, and therefore we absolutely repudiate them. From a different perspective, many opposition members justify the EU policy.
From a different perspective, many opposition members justify the EU policy. However, experts say the EU sanctions are unfounded and influenced by Washington.
The EU is mistaken in politically following the US meddlesome policy. The truth is, most political parties are running in these legislative elections.
Despite the aggression by the EU, the government of Venezuela says Maduro will go on as the country's president and parliamentary elections will be held this year because Venezuela is a free country and it won't be brought to its knees by foreign sanctions. Jesus Silva Caracas.
In a somber silence, France marked 5 years since the November 15 attacks. 130 people were killed in what is the country's deadliest peacetime attack. Takfiri extremists linked to Daesh claimed responsibility for the attack as a response to France's military involvement in Syria and Iraq. Prime Minister Jean Castex led the commemorations as France finds itself in the midst of more Takfiri extremism and growing Islamophobia, polarizing the population. In the past few weeks, Takfiri extremists have killed 4 people after a series of Islamophobic statements from President Emmanuel Macron, as well as the overt promotion of blasphemous cartoons of Prophet Muhammad. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan also condemned Macron's rhetoric.
Mekke, Medine,
It is an issue of honor for us to stand against the attacks against our prophet who honored the entire world. The West are once again heading for a period of barbarity. France and Europe in general, they don't deserve the policies of Macron and those with similar mindsets that spread seeds of hate.
French Muslim leaders have condemned all forms of violence and have called for restraint. France is also calling for a crackdown of foreign funding that it says stokes extremist sentiments. But wide-ranging condemnation of the entire Muslim community by politicians has only deepened divisions. Yesterday, France hosted the Paris Peace Forum, where leaders discussed the ongoing threat of extremism.
No one can say when the pandemic will stop, nor when terrorism will be vanquished. So we cannot wait. We must lead the fight back and build structures that will allow us to better foresee these global threats.
The 2015 attacks shocked the world and damaged relations between communities. President Macron has since tried to dampen emotions, but France remains at a crossroads. Any further Islamophobic sentiments will only flame the tensions.
Trump and his fellow Republicans keep insisting that the U.S. presidential election was rigged, calling for a recount of ballots in several key states. Trump and his team have filed several lawsuits contesting the outcome of the election. However, they have suffered legal setbacks in three battleground states, namely Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Arizona. Courts there rejected Republicans' call for probing the vote count process and blocking mail-in ballots. Meanwhile, U.S. prosecutors have asked Attorney General William Barr to rescind a memo that instructed them to publicly investigate allegations of vote counting irregularities. The prosecutors say they have not seen any unusual activity. Barr sent his memo after days of attacks on the integrity of the election by President Donald Trump and his Republican allies. Although Trump has refused to concede defeat, he said in recent remarks that time will tell which administration will take office in the White House in January.
Whatever happens in the future, who knows which administration it will be? I guess time will tell.
The remarks are the first indication that Trump could concede defeat in the disputed November 3rd presidential election. Still, some of Trump's supporters, as well as his fellow Republicans, are refusing to budge and remain hopeful that their candidate still has the chance to become the next president. The controversy over the election results comes against the backdrop of pro- and anti-Trump demonstrations. Trump supporters back his vote-rigging claims, while his opponents are happy with the projected victory of Joe Biden. Nevertheless, experts believe the nature of the U.S. regime will not change no matter who takes the reign at the White House.
What we're seeing is that the people who control both parties, the Democrats and Republicans, they want Trump out. You know, Trump is not perfect by any means. He's actually really bad for the American people. But the one thing that we can all give him credit is that he exposed the reality of the U.S. empire. He showed just how brutal it is. And I think for a lot of people on Wall Street and Washington who want to rebrand U.S. empire, Trump is too dangerous. And it's looking every day like Trump may be forced to concede.
Now, it remains to be seen who will be confirmed in office as the next U.S. president and whether or not there will be any major policy changes in the new administration.
On September 17, a resolution issued by the European Parliament urged EU member states to impose an arms embargo on Saudi Arabia over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the Yemen war. The resolution also contained an arms embargo on Cairo and Ankara, motivated by concerns Europeans' arms and military equipment might be used for internal repression in Egypt, and that Turkey's conduct in the eastern Mediterranean Sea would run counter to the sovereignty of any EU member state. While some EU countries such as Germany, Finland and Denmark have adopted restrictions on the arms exports to Riyadh, Italy and other EU nations have ignored the resolution in full so far.
It's unacceptable that Egypt, a country known for human rights abuses, is the top importer of Italian weapons across the world. Saudi Arabia follows. We can't accept the countries involved in wars continue to receive our military equipment. Unfortunately, Italy hasn't done much since the EU Parliament adopted the resolution.
An Italian government report has found that the Unit for the Authorizations of Armament Materials green-lighted 57 times last year the supply of military systems, including bombs, torpedoes, rocket launchers and missiles, worth about 200 million euros to Saudi Arabia and UAE.
One in four arms sold worldwide in 2019 were produced in Europe, according to a report by CIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. France and Germany topped the list of European countries that trade in arms, while Italy came third.
We often look at the US as the main arms supplier worldwide. However, we forget that Europe also plays a major role. If the European Parliament only issues resolutions and not directives, all those countries not observing arms embargo cannot be sanctioned. Furthermore, there is a lack of political will among EU countries for change. European companies even compete with one another to sell more arms in conflicting countries.
Consecutive Italian governments have also ignored a domestic law passed in 1990 which bans the exports of weapons in countries in a state of war. Italy's arms exports stood at over 5 billion euros in 2019. Max Civili, Rome.
The United States presidential election continues to be unfinished and disputed. Democrat Joe Biden holds a slim lead, but President Donald Trump has significant public support from Republicans at the grassroots and elite levels to not concede. The election was preceded by months of controversy regarding the unprecedented use of mail-in ballots, which appeared to swing the election in the slight favor of Joe Biden at the last minute. A recent poll showed that a whopping 70% of Republicans do not believe the election was free and fair. Polls held just prior to the vote showed just half the number of Republican skeptics. Democrats say vote fraud has not yet been proven and that Trump must concede to prevent increasing distrust towards the nation's electoral process. But this is the third disputed election in the last six tries. Many are insisting that this election must be judicially vetted in order to prevent even more alienation, apathy, abstention, and anger. Others say the economic, social, and health disaster caused by the coronavirus makes this not the year to insist on transparency.
Six elections, that's my entire lifetime. So one in two of elections in my lifetime, and only I've been able to only vote in the last, I think, three of them. Or four of them. That says a lot about people's uncertainty of these elections, and that's just only going to grow if the system remains how it is.
The repeated electoral chaos is likely to undermine perpetual U.S. claims that their model of democracy is not only the best, but should be emulated around the world. Harvard ranked U.S. election integrity just 57th in the world. And that was last year.
This is not a model of a political system that would want to be mimicked. And it would only be mimicked if it's being used by the powerful. It would only be mimicked by them because they want something that undermines a majority view. And yeah, you should reject that entirely. If you really are for the small d democracy, if you're really for that, you would reject the American model of electing presidents.
The corporate-dominated U.S. mainstream media appears to have a united front that Biden won the election and that any legal challenges are frivolous. A significant percentage of over 70 million Trump voters don't appear to agree. Weeks of chaos and tensions appear certain as the Electoral College, the vote which actually decides the U.S. president, doesn't meet until December 14th. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Hezbollah leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that indirect talks between Lebanon and Israel will continue over the maritime border demarcation, stressing that this does not mean it will lead to normalization. In a televised address to mark Lebanon